Hello and welcome to the November edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor and in a moment I'll be joined by Chris Collins and head gardener here at Garden Organic, Emma O'Neill. This month we're celebrating the slow beauty of autumn, from the changing of the leaves to creating colourful bulb trifles for the spring. There's still so much joy you can get out of your garden as we prepare for shorter days and longer nights. Later on, I chat with Helena Dove, kitchen gardener at Royal Botanic Gardens Kew. Helena has a wealth of knowledge surrounding the physiology of vegetables and teaches us how we can better understand the life cycle of plants. This month, we'll be answering your questions on using black plastic on top of your compost heap, how to help overwintering larvae, and how to prevent your apples from developing bitter pit. But now it's time to catch up with Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm very good, Fiona. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. You're looking well.
I feel good, actually. I like this time of year. I like the freshness of the mornings and the heavy dews. And yeah, it's good. Yeah, so nice. There's a peace to it.
Yeah, it agrees with you. Yeah. Definitely. Well, I've been loving the leaves, I have to say. My garden, I've got a few mature trees in my garden. And now's the time when, of course, the leaves are all sort of coming down. But there's an extraordinary light in the garden because of these beautiful coloured leaves.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's been a slow autumn. And that's always good because it's slow and mild and it happens slowly and the colours tend to come right out.
Yeah.
You know, so if you get an early frost or big wind and it's suddenly over, whereas this has really crept along, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It came up quite suddenly in the first instance,
yes,
didn't it?
Yeah.
Suddenly one weekend we suddenly realised
autumn is here. Yeah.
But then you're right, the colours have deepened. Mm. Yes. I hadn't thought of it like that.
I get a train out to Essex to one of my work, and just the railway banks, the colours along the railway banks have been pretty spectacular this year.
Yeah, So tell us about the balcony, because of course you're right up in the treetops there.
I am. It's quite a spectacular sight, actually, because I live next to two huge parks as well. So it's actually, in the summer, you don't even look like you're in London, even though I'm near Green Lane, which is the big artery that goes all the way to the left. But it's very, very beautiful. But yeah, it's all big change. I like this time of year because I like my seasonal gardening. I always have. I had an amazing year for aubergines, tomatoes. Well, tomatoes have been ridiculous this year. Lots of chilies, but bedding's been good, but that's all come out now. So that's all been lifted. I've done a little bit of compost chain, and that's my bulb time, isn't it? I'm thinking ahead to the spring. So yeah. I've been making my bulb trifles, not lasagna, trifles,
yes,
okay?
Yeah, I know.
Lasagna is a dull colour, trifles are bright colours. That's how
yes.
I was it. And so I've been doing that, organic bulbs, of course. And so, yeah, it's quite an interesting time because you put it in and you're thinking ahead like every gardener does.
Is it too late? I mean, here we are in November. Is it too late if you haven't done your bulb trifle?
No. I've gone right the way up to Christmas before with bulbs, so I think that October, November are optimal, I think.
Yes,
you're certainly all right now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, good Christmas presents as well. So just give us a quick rundown. I know you've done this year on year, but for any new listeners who don't know anything about how to make a bulb trifle, give us a quick recipe.
Well, I try and get as much flowering period as possible. So I look at what I'm doing. Bulb size tends to dictate the level of the depth you're planting. Obviously, an allium bulb is quite big, a tulip bulb is quite big, a crocus corm is quite small.
Right, so big at the bottom.
Yeah, small at the top.
Okay.
And then just try and think about the longevity of the container or basket, or even if it's open ground. You want to have your crocus out. If you've got snowdrop, put some of them in there first. Mm. And you get your crocuses, because they come out late February, March. Get your sort of early, sort of mid-season daffs, so they come next. Late season daffs, so you've gone February, March, April with the daffs. Then your tulips, get late flowering tulips. They come in May. And your alliums is early June. So you get this long run of colour, which is actually just economically, they're one of the biggest bargains going, because they never really let you down. And so, but try and think about that. The mixed varieties, that planting depth's good. We've got that. But try and think about how you get a long, long roll of colour.
So it sounds fantastic, Chris. I love the idea of extending the length and, you know, going for almost 6 months with this one pot. You know, that's fantastic. But just tell me about how the sort of cycle affects it, because presumably those early flowers, they're going to die before the next lot come along.
Yeah.
So then you have got dead foliage.
You have indeed. In fact, what's interesting actually, because crocus, you get their foliage, the long strap foliage, like bootlace foliage, but they just disappear so quick. But ultimately, I try to leave the dead foliage in place for 3 or 4 weeks because I want to recycle the bulbs. They'll go out into the garden at the front. So I will leave it. You could just cut it off. your bowl might be blind next year.
Right.
So what I try and do is try and give a little bit of a beat, let the foliage yellow up a bit, and then I'll cut it off. So the bulb's retracting some of the nutrient in it, and obviously it's photosynthesized, the bulb's reusable. So it's a good question. So you have to put up a bit of tattiness, but my focus is usually on the flower anyway. When you've got a basket of bright red tulips,
yeah,
you're kind of not looking at anything else. But it's a good question. But so let things die back a bit naturally. It's a bit tatty, but that's how I let it work. Yeah.
And do you oversow right at the top with anything that's perhaps not a bulb?
Yes, I do. I'm a classic park, you know, I'm a parksman. So I go for the classic spring bedding. I'll have over the top of my bulbs, I'll have either wallflower, which I love wallflower. Forget-me-nots is my favourite.
Yes.
I love forget-me-nots. And they've started free seeding on my balcony as well a little bit.
Yeah.
So forget-me-nots I really, really love. And of course, the classic pansy. So you get that display when you plant them, bulbs underneath. Come the spring, you get that classic parks display.
Okay, so we've got... So really, you're going kind of really, the size thing is really interesting because you get these big bulbs on the bottom, tiny bulbs on the top, but then you're scattering seeds.
Actually, I'll probably buy plugs for this.
Okay.
Yeah, but you can grow seed.
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, my forget-me-nots are grown from seed.
Yeah.
So they're biannual, the threatening-nots, so I tend to start them the following year. But yeah, so you've got those three layers, but I can get all that in a half-hanging basket.
Yeah.
One thing about these plants is they don't need a lot of space and they'll just crack on with it. And so that's why I'm saying they're so resilient and you get your money's worth out of them because you've got a little tiny basket on a rail and it'll just produce this fantastic display for you.
Yeah. All right, and make a brilliant Christmas present as well, actually, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
Yeah, all right. So it's been quite dry, hasn't it? As
It seems to have been to me,
yeah. We're all very much noticing, you know, the differences in our climate. But I think also we're all a nation of weather watchers anyway, aren't we? And I just wonder how much, as gardeners, you know, how important it is to really think about the weather and rather than worry about what the books say about what you're going to do next. I mean, here we are in the November podcast, we're talking about bulbs and planting bulbs. But actually, we also need to encourage us all to be a little more observant about, you know, the changes that are going on around us. And what changes are you kind of noticing?
Well, I'm noticing a seasonal shift. The seasons are not as predictable, if you like, as they were. I mean, it's a difficult one because you have memories tend to be nostalgic. So you think, oh, that happened then.
Yes.
So it's hard to determine. But I've always been a weather watcher. I think it's part of the job. I really do. So, you know, that's how you determine whether you need to water stuff or, you know, when to put stuff in or where the movements are. So that's quite fundamental that you're part weatherman, I think.
Okay.
And it's definitely different because it feels to me the seasons are a little bit less predictable.
Yeah.
You know, so we go up like November, there's no frost yet, you know, that kind of stuff. So that affects how you're going to go about stuff. Watering, irrigation, I've still got crops in the allotment. Can't let it go bone dry completely. So you are looking at what's going on, definitely.
And I suppose I'm thinking that you wouldn't typically imagine that you'd need to maybe water at this time of year, but it is all about keeping in touch, isn't it?
It is. Gardening is an observation game, I think. It really is. And I think what I like about being an organic gardener is it's very observational, the fact that you're looking at your plants much more closely. If you look at an irrigation system or you suddenly seasonally garden and you cut it off in November, whereas I like to garden all year round, so I like to stay in touch with what I've planted and what's growing and how well they look and how healthy they are, really. It's a skin-in-the-game thing, isn't it?
If
you grow something from seed, I want it to succeed. I put all that effort in for nothing.
Give us a quick walk around the allotment.
Well, it's quite good. I tend to leave a lot of stuff in the ground this time of year. And obviously, a lot of the seasonal stuff's gone over. I've got green manures in. But I've still got a lot of parsnip in there. Same in my kitchen garden that I run. They're sitting in there, and I'll pull them as I need them. I think root crops, carrot included as well, swedes, turnips, like a bit of cold on them. They tend to sweeten up. So they'll just sit. I've got Christmas potatoes.
Yeah.
I've got Mary's Piper in the ground. They're all there. And I've got a lot of kale, broccoli. I've got a Savoy cabbage sitting out there. They also tend to be much tastier after a bit of cold weather. So I'm not pulling on grazing really now. Grazing, and I have the other side of the story is I have a polytunnel and I've got loads of greens, leafy greens on the go. So I've got Indian mustard, actually some of it's from your Heritage Seed Library, which is wonderful peppery spicy mustard. I've got a lot of microgreens on the go, so I'm doing Mizuma as a microgreen. I'm doing salad leaves as microgreens. I'm doing normal salad leaves, you can graze those as well. I've got radish, beetroot, both in the polytunnel as well. So there's still lots going on, but that protective polytunnel extends my season. Yeah. I've sown a lot in there, and it's quite nice looking it up at my kitchen garden, because that's obviously going out of the polytunnel and into the kitchen, and it's getting eaten by children, and they're so very satisfying about that.
Yeah, no, lovely. Absolutely lovely. Earlier in the year, I kind of got all gung-ho and said I was going to really try and succeed with five crops. So I just want to give you a little bit of an update.
Yes.
Potatoes was interesting because I had so many potatoes that came up from last year that must have still been in the ground. I thought I'd harvested them, that I ended up with a whole row of volunteer potatoes, as they call them. So that's been quite fun.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to have done the plants any harm at all.
Yeah.
They seem perfectly happy, even though obviously they're in the same spot for a year. But so I've enjoyed that. I've just sort of let that do its thing. I'm afraid of a couple of other things that I never actually got in. One was sweet corn, the other was parsnips. Meant to do it, just didn't quite do it. Even bought my parsnip seed, because parsnip you have to sow fresh each year, because I sowed it one time and didn't get anywhere. And then I was corrected by on the podcast and told you need to sow fresh seed with parsnips. So I went and purchased my fresh seed and then I never sowed it. Absolutely ridiculous.
Well, you're a busy lady.
I am too busy. That's the problem. Yeah, exactly. Do a lot of talking about gardening, not a lot of getting in the garden, unfortunately. But the leafy greens has been interesting because this has been a phenomenal year for the amaranth seed that I just scattered and thought, I wonder what's going to happen. And it's just been a joy. You know, I'd really recommend it to anybody. So easy to grow. You know, it's a fantastic replacement for spinach. It looks marvellous. Yes, it will seed everywhere. That's the one thing. But on the other hand, do I mind that? Well, you know, if I'm weeding out,
if there's extra ones, you can just hoe them off. It's all right.
Hoe them off, or it's ground cover, isn't it? So I'm not gonna get too worried about that. I also did really well with Italian parsley, which I sowed in the spring in the greenhouse, and it's still going. It's absolutely fantastic. I did really well with Heritage Seed Library lettuce. I had two rows in the greenhouse. Again, really brilliant. I did really well with tomatoes. That wasn't on my top five, but it did do really well with those. So that's been fun. So it hasn't been a total disaster. But
good.
The other things that I said I was going to try were and try and sort of succeed with were runner beans. Mm. Now, my issue with beans is that I'm not very good at building the structures, you know, and that's where I think I go wrong. So I spend quite a lot of time worrying about the fact that I haven't got a structure up. I then fling something up, isn't that great?
Yeah.
And then stick the beans in and hope for the best. So I think that's the key. It comes down to the structure. Yeah. But it wasn't a good year for me with runner beans, and I think it was a bit too hot and dry for me in my garden. They're in a very hot, they're at the top of the garden, and it gets really dry there. So I think that's not been great for my runner beans, but I have saved some seed.
That's good. So you'll be able to use them again. Yeah, they like the moisture at the beginning. I think that if you don't water at the beginning, the roots tend to come to the surface, so they're more vulnerable to drying out. So deep watering at the beginning of the time. As for the structure, put that up in February, put that up in the winter.
Yeah.
So you go to my allotment, every runner bean structure is up in February, ready, waiting.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually.
Yeah, so they do all that construction stuff in the winter. So when the growing gets going, it's all in place. So that's kind of the discipline.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, maybe you need to be giving me a good lot of information in January podcast.
Yeah. Okay. I'll remember that. I will.
Yeah.
Because I'll be playing around with a structure. I always do, don't I? Every year. I always like to move stuff about. So it might be difficult to forget. Yeah.
Other things that I just did anyway that weren't part of my kind of five that I promised I was going to do. And that is I've done really well with beetroot.
It's been so delicious to eat. It's been my favourite this year.
So yeah. I've left it really late to harvest it. So I need to report back on it because I want to harvest it this month and start to roast it and use it. And so, but it looks beautiful on the top. The tops of it have been gorgeous. So I have used some of the leaves in salad. So that's been great. And then this is my little triumph has been I grew Bradford Bomb cabbage. And this is a Heritage Seed Library variety. And I used to live in Bradford.
Right,
so
okay.
I thought, I've got to give this a go. And I think we talked earlier in the year about a terrible aphid damage. And you said, hold your nerve, it'll be all right.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. They've really come back. I'm now waiting to get a bit of cold weather on them before I harvest them. But they look absolutely brilliant. They've become really big. They've hearted up beautifully. Very fond of sauerkraut in our family. So there might be a bit of sauerkraut making going on with them. And then the other thing that's done really well is, as you might remember, I went down and interviewed Hugh Richards, right over on the western point of Wales. You know, walked around his permaculture garden. Big emphasis on perennial veg. Mm. That's his real specialism. You know, he's really good at that. And he grows it and sells it as well at local markets and stuff. And I bought some from him. And the five-star broccoli is a perennial broccoli. I thought that I had it with the aphids and all that sort of stuff. It's just looking marvellous now. I feel like it's coming into its own. It's going to be brilliant next year. Dorbenton kale, again, you know, kind of lots of aphid interest, looking brilliant now. It's a lot of these things. It's just hang in and just see. But I have wanted to have a lot more perennial veg in my patch.
I think if your time is tight, it's a really good idea. Yeah. You have to be a bit thorough with planting, because if you've got weedy area, that weed will get into the plant, so there's that consideration. But certainly for if your time tight, if you know, if you've got much time on your hands, it's a really, really good idea. And a lot of this stuff's really tasty as well. And it's interesting, I think, with the brassicas, the kales and the broccolis and stuff, they always look sad to me and a bit beaten up during the summer, then they just come into life.
Yes, it's like,
the kale I'm growing just looks fantastic now, and so it is. That's one of them, really. A lot of organic, like same with the black aphids on the bean, runner broad beans. I think a lot of it, people see something and panic. I think you let nature sort of take its course and it'll pan out, I think,
And that, I mean, it has been a brilliant year for ladybirds, hasn't it? We've all seen loads and loads.
I stopped a cricket match because there's so many of them this year.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Absolutely brilliant. Bring on the ladybirds. So in our autumn edition of our members magazine, The Organic Way, for those of you listening who are members, and if you're not, then you know, do go and have a look about how you can become a member of Garden Organic, because you get loads of resource from us. We're a force for good, so please do go and consider that. And one of the things that you get as part of membership is you'll get a magazine three times a year, and it's absolutely stuffed full of really good ideas and tips and thoughts and all the very latest in organic growing and gardening. So this time we've got a great feature on growing crops, either in undercover, really. So either in a greenhouse or a polytunnel or maybe even a cold frame. I think this is important to say that it doesn't all stop. We've just talked about perennial veg just being brilliant during the winter. But actually there's plenty of things you can carry on growing, particularly things to eat. So tell me what you're growing right now.
It's interesting because last year I went right through the winter in a polytunnel, because obviously you've got that protection and so you can carry on the season. But really, I mean, it's sort of Asian sort of crops, leafy crops, like I've had massive amazuma on the go at the moment, mustards, that kind of stuff. So those sort of salad-y crops come again, salad leaves, all that, microgreens are all, I'll keep them going through the winter as long as I can. And it's interesting, things like even little gem, the lettuce little gem, what I tend to do with that is rather than it let it thin out, I can crop that off a little bit and let it reshoot its leaves. And that tends to be continuous as well. But that little bit of protection from the structure definitely extends my season.
Yeah. And when you say microgreens, what are you sowing?
I've got quite a few. I've got mustards, a brilliant microgreen. I've got mazuma's been pretty good microgreen. And I've got leafy salad leaves as well. They're the three main ones. Radish seed's really good. Chard seed is really good as well. Chard is really delicious in a microgreen. So they're quite good. So I've got these big crates in the polytunnel. I've filled them up and I broadcast sow. So I sow them lovely and thick, rake them in, give them a little rake over, and then they come up really thick and they great. You just take them as you need them, really.
Yeah.
Really excellent way to keep good organic food in your kitchen this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, important to say, it's really important to have organic seed for microgreens, because that seed is going to be producing a crop for you in, you know, days, weeks, you know, not you. You don't want to be having to deal with a non-organic coating on a seed, because that's, you're going to end up eating the seed with the microgreens. So you need to really, really think about your seeds and make sure they're organic.
Yeah, source them organically is the best way. Yeah. You know, you're safe then.
Going a bit bigger than microgreens, let's think about the bigger plants that we all love so much. It's a really good time of year for tree planting.
Well, I like to shrub or treat, to be honest with you. I like to plant. This is my time for that, really.
Yeah.
Autumn, if you like. The reason simple is that the soil is still warm. So that means that the roots will get down quicker. The photosynthesis levels start to decrease. The days are getting shorter. Plant will concentrate on root production. If it's a tree, it wants anchorage, so it gets its roots down that way as well. Good little tip is always plant into a square hole, not a round one. A square hole basically means is if you've got a round one, it just tends to cascade round and round in circles. Wherever it finds a right angle, a right edge, it will force its way out. This is good old Tony Kirkham, who ran Kew Arboretum for years. This is part of his work, and he's pretty much the best tree man, you know, world authority. So a square hole as well. But this is a really good time to do it. Do a square hole this time of year so the roots get down. Don't put any compost into the hole because otherwise the plant goes, this is fine, I don't need to go anywhere, and the roots will stay in the hole. But a good mulch on top as well, so that protects them from frosts or drying out a little bit as well.
So we're talking a bare-rooted tree.
In the winter, I would definitely only bare root, yeah.
Yeah, so you need to get hold of a bare root tree in the first place, which is not always straightforward. You're most likely going to need to order that from a...
from a wholesaler, usually, yes,
or specialist nursery. Yeah. And there are a couple of organic nurseries that we could definitely recommend. Woolcott Organic Nurseries is one worth looking up. Tamar do organic fruit trees and fruit bushes too. And when you say don't put compost in the hole, you don't mean don't put soil in the hole.
No, you put back the soil you've taken out.
Taken out your soil.
Yeah, so the soil in the hole is the same as the surrounding soil.
Yep.
So the tree will then naturally forage out with its roots.
Yes.
Whereas one of the problems was, this is another Tony Kirkham thing, and one of the problems they were having was they're putting lovely, lovely compost in the hole and the plant was going, well, this is fine, I don't need to go anywhere. And it's an interesting point because roots forage. So they'll go after pockets of nutrients. So oak trees are quite famous for this. They'll go, oh, there's nutrients over here. And then so the roots are moving around. They're live.
All the time.
Yeah, so you've got to bear that in mind with a young plant. You want that plant to get out and find nutrients.
It's so interesting, isn't it, to think of a plant in motion.
Yes, yeah. And also now they're discovering they communicate through roots and through mycorrhizae or through fungus as well. If a tree's in trouble, they might exchange nutrients that way. Again, this whole soil thing, we're just finding out more and more and more about it. It's incredible. It's a whole science. I was just talking earlier, and apparently we only know 1% of all the microorganisms that are in our soil. We just know so little about it, you know. And so that journey of discovery is, I think, really, really fascinating.
A few weeks ago, I visited Kew Gardens, where I met with their kitchen gardener, Helena Dove. Helena has just written a book titled The Botany of the Kitchen Garden. I asked her first why she felt it was so important for gardeners to understand the science behind the food that we grow.
I've been growing professionally for 10, 12 years, and I've been growing vegetables generally for 15, 20 years since I was little, which is much more than that. And I have come to understand that to get the best crops, you have to really understand the plants. So where they originate from, which bit of the plant you're going to eat, so which bit of the plant you need to encourage. And all that I learnt is the botany, basically. It's going to be a bit of a scary science word, but actually just understand how the plant is and how it works. And I think basically the reason the book came about is my partner was fed up of me telling him about it, and he suggested that maybe I should tell other gardeners about it instead. So that's kind of how the book started. He even agreed to do the illustrations for me, which is very lucky because I can't draw. And that's how it came about. And I spoke to other kitchen gardeners who all said, oh yeah, no, this would be really interesting. Where, you know, everyone's had the How to Grow a Vegetable Garden book over and over again. So now this is another book you can gift to people who are interested in growing, which will hopefully just get the best out of the crops by understanding where they all come from.
We'll talk about your job here at Kew in a minute, but just to dive into that, first of all, when you're walking around a kitchen garden, where in fact do those plants come from?
So there's a wide variety, and that's what makes the kitchen garden a little bit more tricky, I would say. Not many of them are natives to the UK, for example, or native to wherever you might be growing. We have some, the brassicas, so often quite native, but everything else comes from all over the world. So we're trying to give plants that, you know, tomatoes come from the Americas, which is quite hot. You've got other plants that come from cooler climates that maybe don't want such heat. You've got things like cranberries that quite like the wet. So when you look around the kitchen garden, everything's come from everywhere. And that is sort of the trick of the kitchen garden, I think, is to sort of try and give everything what it needs, which keeps you busy, if nothing else. So yeah, a lot of things come from hot climes, especially our summer crops. And that sort of is tricky. I mean, this year, not so tricky, but we don't know what next year is going to bring. And for example, the autumn is looking like it might be very cool and maybe very wet. So it's how we manage to keep their lifespan going. So yeah, so they come from all over, I think is the best way of putting it.
And going back more than that then, so, you know, first of all, to think that actually if you're a vegetable grower, a food grower, a fruit grower as well, the chances are that you're growing crops from all over the place because things have migrated here. But actually what we're growing now is the result of many, many years and generations of breeding. One of the things that you talk about in the book is really kind of examining the botany of certain vegetables. What is it about the carrot that means that it's actually so hard to grow?
Yeah, carrots are one of my nemesis. I think just to start off, everyone is always told to grow a carrot as the beginner crop, and they are hard work. So if we took it back to just a carrot, not a cultivar, just a wild carrot, they're what we, when they're in the family Apiaceae, and Apiaceae plants produce umbels, which produce a lot of seed. And they're very light little seeds that are carried by the wind. If you think of cow parsley, that's the sort of thing we're looking at. Anything that produces, well, not everything, but most plants that produce a lot of seed are producing a lot of low quality seed, whereas plants that produce one or two seeds will produce one or two very good quality seeds. So with carrots, you've got a lot of seed, but not all of them are going to germinate particularly well. The other thing that is they don't like is being dried out. So you have to keep the soil really, really wet because they're sort of papery. They have to keep moist to germinate. In the wild carrots, they would release their seed at a time the rains were coming. So they'd land on the ground and it would get wet. We put them in a packet and we sow them whenever we want to. So we have to make sure they're kept wet to germinate. And then one of the things a wild carrot does is it has produced loads of seed, so you get quite a lot of germination. So if one or two things get munched, you'll still get plants. We do ours in beautiful long rows, and then we thin out ourselves, and then a slug comes along. Almost inevitably, a slug will come along after you've thinned out. So you're starting to see all these stages that the plant has overcome by just producing excessive amounts. It doesn't matter about rows. It doesn't matter about spacing even. We have spacing because we want a carrot that's about 4 centimetres wide. It doesn't really care about that in the wild. So it cares about getting the next set of carrots growing. So it sort of becomes quite difficult for that. So it needs to be kept wet, but it also needs a bit of heat. But we want ours in straight rows. We want the 4 centimetres gaps. But we can't guarantee that all this seed is very good quality. So we're starting to see these issues growing. And then also we put it in an environment. So it comes from fairly warm climates where there probably aren't slugs. They quite like sandy soil. They tend to be, so we're growing them in whatever soil we've got. So this is kind of where you see the wild plants being put into a domesticated situation. And that's where we start to bump up against things. We can overcome all of those, obviously, but it is a tricky little thing. It's a true root crop as well. A lot of our root crops that we call root crops, like potatoes, aren't true roots. A potato is a modified stem. It's a bit easier to play with. A true root crop is the actual root that has been modified and swollen for us to eat. So the issue with that is if it gets damaged, that's the root that is actually damaged. They will fork, as you'll have seen, but that isn't a crop that we necessarily want. I don't mind it. So yeah, being a true root crop, we also can't start it in a module inside very easily and transplant it, because as soon as it hits the bottom of a module, it'll break the root. And you don't see, everyone thinks they'll see, I've done this, you think you're going to see the bottom of that root, but actually the bottom of that root is one cell thick. You aren't going to see that. So it will hit the bottom of the module very easily. So they have to be direct sown to be successful, which means they're really open to the elements out there. So yeah, there's lots of issues with them.
But actually it's the botany of the wild relative, of the crop wild relative, that tells you that and actually informs how we can grow things better. Can you just outline for us some botany basics? That would be really helpful.
Yeah. So botany does cover a large array of things. One of the key things, I think, is knowing where a plant comes from. So its origins. So knowing that a cabbage is a maritime plant is really helpful, because at the coast, you don't get extreme heats and you don't get extreme colds. It doesn't freeze very often, but it doesn't get extremely hot because you've got a lot of humidity, which tells us that although brassicas will freeze, they really don't like fluctuating temperatures. They don't love that. So that helps with cabbages. So yeah, and knowing that a tomato comes from a hot climate lets us know that it's not going to live through a winter in the UK because it's not going to live through the cold. Botany also could be knowing about plant parts. So knowing which bit the root is, which bit the flower is in the kitchen. And that sounds really, really basic. But we do need to think about that when we're thinking about how we get the best out of a plant. So knowing that a tomato is a fruit is really useful because the fruit contains the seed. If the point of the plant is to produce seed, if that's what its aim is, then if we want lots of tomatoes, we have to keep removing the fruit so that it keeps making more seed. So it's sort of things that we sort of know, I would say. We all know that if you want lots of peas, you keep picking the peas so it produces more, the pods. But maybe we don't understand why. And the other thing it really helps us with is it can be feeding. Although I don't feed my plants, I feed my soil so that everything's there. You know that if you're looking for fruit to feed with something for fruits or something for roots, it's sort of really helpful. Brassicas are a really great example of knowing which bit of the plant you're eating. Most of the brassicas we eat, cabbages, kohlrabi, Brussels sprouts, they're all the same plant. They've just got a different bit of the plant that's been bred. So Brussels sprouts, it's a little axial bud under the arm, which is I'm doing a very good impression of right now. A cabbage is the head, is the head bud. So it's just kind of understanding which bit you're eating as to what bit you need to manipulate, I guess. So yeah, basically it's where it comes from and how it grows and what bit of it it is that you're working with that helps you get a better kitchen garden.
Can you tell us a little bit about your job and this extraordinary space that you work in every day?
Yeah, I'm incredibly lucky. Just to do this as a job is amazing. I run a relatively small kitchen garden, about a quarter of an acre, which I think is big enough. Thank you very much. So we have, it's an educational site. That is what we do. And there's two sides to the education. One is just showing people how to grow. Not everyone knows how to grow a carrot, or I even get kids that don't know that apples come from trees. So it's really educational that way. The other thing that we are focusing on is climate change. It is happening. It is actually here, I think, is what we've established. This summer kind of proves that. And how we work alongside that. So there are several different strains to that. And partially what I get to do, which is really interesting, is I can play, really. I can experiment with growing crops. And it doesn't, like a farmer couldn't experiment. They have to have a crop that is going to have an outcome. I can try crops from all around the world. And if they don't work, they don't work. It's not, no, I've not lost my profit. So one of the strains is to look at, they call it future foods. I just try and crops from different countries. So the potato is going to become harder to grow in the UK because of blight, which is becoming more prevalent, sadly. And unless you're going to spray with chemicals, which are also not working because blight basically mutates so fast that it's always going to be a little bit ahead. What could we, rather than saying, okay, we just keep breeding the potato, which people are doing and that's really helpful, what could we grow alongside it? So where it comes from in the Andes, originally the farmers who grew potatoes never grew just potatoes. It's really only farmers in the Western society that grow monocultures. Originally, they were grown as part of what we call the Andean Five, which was potatoes, okra, ulleku, yacon, and mashua. And they're all root crops. And if the potato grows in this country, there's really no reason why those other crops won't grow in this country. And they all grow. Now, the potato was what we call a short day plant, which means it doesn't start tuberizing or producing tubers until basically the day length is shorter than the night length. So for here, that's about September. But we can breed that out of it, and it was bred out of it. It's now what we call a day-neutral plant, and it will start producing tubers anywhere in the year. So all these other crops are actually also short-day plants, which is what is one of the biggest issues. So the issue in the UK is that, say, okra, which is a lovely little lemony tuber, and it's really nice, really delicious. That is currently a short day plant. So it starts tuberizing about now, but it is not hardy. So if we get an early frost, it only gets about 6 weeks to really produce crops. Thankfully, people in the UK are breeding and working on these plants to sort of make them day neutral, which is really, really important. Also, flavour is really, really important. So okra, I really like. Lemony, mashua, I really like. It's like a sort of mustardy flavour. So it would work really well on a Sunday roast. The ulleku, we can no longer really grow in this country because it has a disease that affects our potato crop. So we've been asked to not grow it. Defoliate, we definitely don't save it. So that's been really interesting. But this is why we have to experiment and work really hard to bring things in that will work. So we're just kind of looking at what we can go alongside that. We're trying different leafy crops because lettuces are really hard to grow in the summer and they really need a lot of water, which isn't very sustainable. So I've been growing Malabar spinach, which is from the coast of India. And that's been really good. It's a climbing plant, produces a crop that's actually really nice, really tasty. The chefs here really like working with it. And that's been really good in the hot summers as an alternative to spinach, which I just can't grow. Other plants from kind of the Indian Ocean coast are doing really well. So yard-long beans this year have done really, really well, which is really great. And because they are so long, they give you a lot of crop. So that's partially what we're doing. The other part that I think will help with future foods is growing heritage varieties. It is partially just that some of the genetic material in those heritage ones are going to be better suited to our future crops. So we always think that it's maybe we're getting hotter and hotter and hotter and we're growing more exotic things. But a lot of, I found the records of the Georgian kitchen garden and a lot of what they were growing then, like sweet potatoes, we're now growing again. They just kind of fell out of favor, especially during the World Wars. You wouldn't grow things that weren't definitely going to grow. So sweet potatoes hit and miss even now. So they were growing them and we're growing them again. But also heritage varieties, they're all very suited to different climates. So quite often they're very specific, you know, they've been bred in Scotland or they're bred in London or saved there. And that might be that what was saved in London 30 years ago now works really well in Scotland, for example. So it's just so well bred for its circumstance that they're really important. Plus, we just don't know. It might be one of these amazing heritage crops has material that we can breed into a newer crop wild relative and give us a crop for the future that works really, really well. So we're looking at how those heritage varieties might also be helping us fight sort of the future of food.
You just talked then about breeding and using heritage varieties and crop wild relatives. Can you just explain that a bit more?
Yes. Basically, a carrot, a wild carrot and a heritage carrot, they will basically cross. They will work together. So it could be, for example, there's a really lovely old Spanish carrot, really old, which in English is called Black Magic. My pronunciation of the original name is not excellent. And that is really good. It's actually really, really quite good in high temperatures. And the actual carrot is delicious. It's purple. And as we kind of have been told over and over again, purple foods have really good properties. They're really good for your health. So it is really, really good for the heat, but it sort of is a little hit and miss with germination. So it might be that by breeding some of the traits from the heritage carrot alongside some of these wild species that have proven they can work quite well and consistently at a high temperature, if we breed those together, we might have a mix of two carrots that give us a really amazing carrot, purple carrot for the future that consistently works well in high temperatures. And I think that's why it's really important to not just go forget about heritage cultivars, forget what was grown 100 years ago, because the material, the information that those seeds have could be so important for our future.
It's a kind of bridge, isn't it, between the crop wild relative and today's breeding methods. The heritage varieties are just such a crucial gene bank, really.
Yeah, they are. And they're also much wider in terms of So when it comes to cultivars, what is sold is obviously what we mainly have access to, but it's a very narrow strip of what exists. And if people aren't keeping and maintaining those heritage varieties, which is an incredibly wide bank of genetic data, if we aren't saving those, then they will be lost. And it doesn't really matter how much wild species we've crossed. If we've got something in the bank that's already there, we should be using it. We should be saving it, which is why it's so important to grow them, but also saving your own seed. Because one year you might have a strain of a bean that just has a quirk of nature about it and it can survive without water. It's not probably going to happen in one generation, but you just never know. And by saving your own seed, you're actually producing your own cultivars over time that's so genetically different to what you started with that it could be your own cultivar. You get to name it yourself, but also it might just be very specific to your growing area. So here in Kew, we are hotter. I only live 20 minutes down the road. It's always a few degrees warmer here. If I was to consistently save a bean in my kitchen garden that did really well, I would probably in the end get something that could put up with the heat and lack of water that I give it. So saving is really, really important, and saving and observing and looking at what your plants are doing and really reacting to that is really important. And that's why the home grow is so important, because they have the time to do that.
The thing about the garden here is it's absolutely rammed full of many, many different plants. Can you just talk a bit about the importance of a wide diversity of plants in your garden?
Well, to be resilient, you have to grow as much as you can. One of the things I personally think has happened with climate change is our lack of predictability and also weather events. So these days, it's not just a bit of wind, it's a full-on storm. It's not just hot, it's 36 degrees. It's not just cold summer, it's 18 degrees and no light. That seems to be the trend. It's not kind of a little bit of something, it's just, it's a lot of something. So it used to be I could fairly predictably grow my tomatoes at this time of year, my peas at that time of year, and they'd all work. This year, my tomatoes did well, my peas haven't. But what I'm doing is alongside those is growing, as well as tomatoes, I'm growing tomatillos next to them because they don't get affected by blight, but they like the slightly hotter temperatures. I grew my peas, but I also grew the yard long beans so that I had legumes. The peas like the cool weather, the yard long beans like the hot weather. Something is going to work. It's just been proven year after year after year. And if you go back to original growers, monocultures don't work. They really don't work. You're reliant on often one cultivar of one crop. We could talk about the lump of potato, but I don't think we need to go back to the Irish potato famine. But it is proof that just growing one thing, one cultivar of one thing specifically, is a really terrible idea. So I grow as much as I possibly can, which means I get success on a hot summer, on a cold summer. If the summer goes on till November, if it stops tomorrow, I'm going to have crops. It may be that I don't get 100% success rate. In fact, I won't get 100% success rate, but by growing loads of different things, I get a lot of output of my garden. We've got a lot of perennial plants for like a slow growing. Again, you don't get as much out of those as you maybe would do a kale, but we get a really good variety of nutrients that way. We've constantly got something cropping. And that's how I think it, if you can, you should be growing. Just grow as many different cultivars, get early, middles, lates if you can. Like peas come in all kinds of different, you know, some of them crop within 12 weeks, some of them crop over 24 weeks. Grow potatoes. I don't grow main crops anymore because it's too stressful. It's very stressful, but grow 20 different cultivars of potato if you can. And alongside that, grow okra, grow mashua, try turnip rooted chervil, try all these things and you'll get crops. And some things won't work, some things will. Keeping a record of everything is chaotic, but it's great fun, I would say. And I think it's really important for resilience.
And we also talk about the importance of diversity for cropping. I guess my final question to you is, if here you are managing the kitchen garden at Kew, and we've talked a lot about observation over this course of this interview, what you're noticing that's happening to the plants, what's succeeding, what's not succeeding, making sure there's always sort of backup plans, that kind of stuff, polyculture, really important over monoculture, no dig, look after the soil as much as you can, feed your soil, not your plants. You know, all of these are kind of really resonant principles that any organic gardener is kind of already adopting. I know for myself that actually understanding the botany behind them is where I, you know, I'm short of knowledge. So this has been absolutely fascinating. But I'm kind of wanting you to sort of take a helicopter view, if you like, of your kitchen garden, and if you could just tell us, you know, what is the overall change that you are noticing in terms of your cropping?
Oh, I think, I mean, this year has been amazing. All the fruits have done really, really well. But I would say overall, I get less of each thing, but more different things. Yeah, I probably, compared to a few years ago, I mean, my currants, my black currants did really, really well. My red currants didn't do so well, but I got a lot of mulberries. So I get a fair amount coming out. I think there's more colour coming out of the kitchen garden actually at the minute. or eating a wider variety. So you're force feeding people Haemorrhoculus flowers and Acca flowers and Wisteria flowers. And I think that I can't tell you what's coming out of the kitchen garden, which drives the chefs up the wall. But when I bring them things, it's always delicious because the climate is giving us some treats, but I can't guarantee it. And I'm not always abundant in what I produce, but yeah, it's that lack of predictability maybe, but that's not very helpful.
So what is it that you are noticing? If you could take a kind of bird's eye view of your kitchen garden, I don't know, maybe over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, what has changed?
I think it's that the big hitters are not reliable anymore. So the potatoes and the carrots and the black currants, they're all cropping, but they're not as reliable as they once were. So what is coming out of the kitchen garden is a much wider variety, but not always predictable, I think. So this year, I'm going to hark on again, but the yard long beans have just been amazing, absolutely stunning. But I really struggled with the runners for a few weeks. Scott going, it's nearly the end of the season. So, and runners were always very predictable, really great. I always count on them, but they just really struggle with the heat. They notoriously lose flowers when it's too hot overnight. It's been really hot and the yard longs have been amazing. Whereas last year, the yard longs didn't really do anything very much. So what I am taking to the kitchen, what I am producing is changing, really changing. And I don't know that I can predict what 10 years time will look like, but I do know we won't be so reliant on just one or two or three crops. It won't just be potatoes that we store in our root cellars over the winter. It won't just be tomatoes that provide a sweet hit in our summer salads. I just think that we will see a much bigger variety of types of fruit and vegetable, but also cultivars. I think we'll see a much bigger variety of the cultivars that we're using. A lot of kind of influx in different growers in the UK, bringing different knowledge. Callaloo's been great this year. I haven't quite got as far as using the flowers of amaranth for grains or even battering them. Apparently they're really nice, but that is a crop that wasn't available in the way it is now, and so therefore the ones that are available are just becoming easier to grow and more abundant. So yeah, I think it's going to be that I'm producing a wide variety of things, but my ability to predict what a year is going to look like and therefore what I'll produce exactly is becoming harder.
So we've come now to the time when we answer your questions, and I'm here with our head gardener here at Garden Organic, Emma O'Neill. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Fiona.
Thanks for being with us. And of course, joined by Chris Collins.
Hi, Chris. Fiona.
Hi there. Right. So off we go, thinking about apples. It's been an absolute must year for apples, hasn't it? Linda has sent us a question. She's saying, how do we stop our apples developing bitter pit?
So bitter pit is down to actually a calcium deficiency. So you don't need to worry. It's not actually from your soil. It's due to the extreme dry weather temperatures we had. So all it actually means is that the apple tree couldn't put the necessary calcium up to the fruit. So to try to prevent that, really, in times of extreme sort of weather, you need to monitor your watering and your irrigation. And I would always mulch the tree well to try and keep the moisture in.
So, Chris, you often mention the orchard that you work in. Have you ever come across this particular problem?
I think it's interesting to hear Emma say that, because when I took it over the first fruiting season, they were all quite bitter, actually, because we've had a few dry summers now. Yeah. Well, dry springs is particularly fundamental, I would have said. But I did mulch them. I got a load of horse manure delivered. I write that down properly, and I mulched them last winter, and they were really good this year, and I wonder whether that moisture retention has really helped them. I think that probably has.
And something to avoid as well is, because often if you have a problem with a plant, you think, oh, feeding is the best thing, but actually if you feed the apples and the level of nitrogen or potash is too high, that will exacerbate the problem.
Okay, so it's all about moisture.
Yeah,
keeping the moisture in, mulching, irrigating if you really think you need to.
Yeah.
And then you should have a lovely sweet fruit at the end of a season. Fantastic. On now to a question from Hilda, who is saying, please, do any of you clever folk know anything about elephant garlic? This year, most of my bulbs have stayed as a single bulb.
So they've not split into bulblets, which is what they usually do. So I'm assuming she started at the beginning of the season by planting her single bulb and was expecting that to then bulk up into what we would, you know, characterise as a head of garlic. This is a really interesting problem. So what causes this then, Emma?
So again, unfortunately, it's down to the dry weather.
Okay.
So it's just not actually had long enough to develop in the ground, probably being under more stress, really. So it is still edible and we can still plant them.
So can she sow them again this year and water them and look after them this year and hopefully then they'll pass up into her head next year? Okay. Okay. So she doesn't need to start again. Chris, what have you got any other tips that you might offer?
I think so. I think that there's two things here. One is they, like all of these sort of edible bulbs, onions and the same, they need quite a long season and they really prefer a cold snap to trigger them, I think. I think they sit there too short a period and then the soil's too warm, they kind of don't get up too much. So make sure you plant them late autumn or early spring so they get that cold snap to get them going. I also find that they can quite enjoy irrigation at the beginning of the season, so keep them moist then. Once they start to establish, you could lay off a bit, I think. The big one, if you've had trouble, is you can start them in pots, kick them off in pots, try to get it maybe so you're not going to disturb the roots too much, but just kick them off in pots and then plant them out. That's another way around it as well.
Okay, but the cold snap is key.
I think it is. They like a long season, don't they? They like a long season,
Yeah, so you can't hurry them along. And it's actually probably better to get them in this side of Christmas.
I think we've ours have been in, haven't they, a while, I think.
Yeah, ours went in last week, some even the week before.
Okay.
Well done. All right, but it's not too late. So we're still in late autumn, but get your garlic in now because it needs it. All right, on to a question from Julie, who says, I'm an allotment holder and on our site we have four large compost bays. Each one is about 2 metres by 4 metres, so quite big. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it is an allotment site, isn't it? So she says, in the past, when a bay is completely filled, it gets covered with black plastic and then it's left for 3 or 4 years and then dug out after that. So she's worried about the plastic. Do you think this would be better to cover this with cardboard rather than plastic? Because Julie's worried that it keeps the heat too dry if you cover it with plastic. That's interesting, isn't it? Because I would have always thought that the plastic would have actually kept the moisture in. So, Chris, where would you go with this? I mean, first of all, why do we need to cover it in the first place?
Yeah, well, I think black plastic's certainly not good because obviously compost heaps need air and water.
Yeah.
So if you're hot composting, you want it to do it quicker, I turn mine and I irrigate it. So if it's dry. So if you've got a dry pile, you put black plastic over, it's going to stay dry. You've got a soaking wet pile, you're going to stay soaking wet and you're getting aerobic conditions.
Yes.
So you need something that's porous. I think Hessian would be the choice of probably me and Emma. So what you've got is where the air can move in and out of it. I actually only prefer to put the cover on it when it's full. I like it to be, so I can get in and turn it and move it. So only when it's full, but it has to be porous. I think the other thing to mention as well is compost bins are ecosystems in their own right. You can get up to 2,000 forms of life associated with a compost bin. So anything, any permanent cover that's plastic and non-porous is going to cut that life out. If you're going to cover it at all, put Hesse on it, something that's porous. And it's interesting, people worry about stuff too. Well, I actually had sprinklers on my compost bin a few days ago because it's been so dry. So if it's not covered, you can gauge it much better. You're looking at it and you can gauge it much better.
Okay. So do you cover it at all?
I will put, when it's full, something over it. But I tell you what, I don't put anything permanent. I will be pulling it back and looking at it.
Yes, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't just cover it and leave it.
That's bad. No, so I put Hessian over it, but I'm inspecting it quite regularly. Because if it gets too dry, it's not going to break down. Yeah. So I might go, well, I need a sprinkler on it.
But you don't bother covering it until it's full up?
No.
Okay, that's interesting. What do we do here, Emma?
Again, very similar to Chris, we won't cover ours until it's full. And what you're wanting is, as well as keeping the heating and the moisture, you're allowing it to finish decomposing over that time. So you want it to stay hot. The other thing, cardboard is fine, but you need to remember that will decompose over time, so that will rust. And so if it tends to rot quite quickly, particularly in wet sort of seasons, but we would use Hessian or straw. You definitely don't want to be using plastic.
Right. Okay. All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay. Now on to a really lovely question here. Going into the winter, of course, but thinking about the smallest forms of wildlife, what can we do to help overwintering larvae is a question we've had. I think that's really specific, isn't it? Let's think about this. First of all, Chris, what would you do to support our insect life?
Well, you know, I'm a big lover of the four seasons when it comes to herbaceous plants, because people tend to think they love all this lovely flower you get and stuff through the summer, which is obviously great. But I love the sight of a straw herbaceous border, a dead herbaceous border, if you like, foliage-wise, with the frost going through it.
Yes.
That's the perfect conditions as well for larvae and stuff for cover through the winter.
Yeah.
So that's definitely one way to go about it. And I think things like nettles, if you've got nettles patches, if you're on a big area, you might get patches of nettles. Let things rot down naturally, I think. Mm. Maybe a little bit different if you've got stuff that's diseased. You might want to remove that, take that out of the equation. But on the whole, don't be over-tidy. Let it find its natural cycle, and that will help those larvae survive.
Okay. Emma, any thoughts?
It's about balance, really, because obviously people will also worry about that larvae that are pests coming along. But you want to leave things as natural as you can, really. So we tend to leave most of our seed heads and things on, creating natural habitats with, you know, log piles, bits of leaf litter around and about. All of those things are providing natural habitats.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, it plays into what you're planting in the first place, because if you have a polyculture, you have a mixed planting, you've got as many different things as possible, a huge diversity, then that's going to support all those species through the winter. So, so it kind of plays in, doesn't it? What you do in spring then works with what you're doing in the winter. So leave it there. You've created an ecosystem. Let it finish its cycle and start again. Of course, a lot of this is resisting the temptation to be too tidy. And I love raking some leaves and that kind of stuff. But, you know, you do see people getting out there with the power tools at this time of year to try and make everything kind of ridiculously overclipped and all the rest of it, which, as we would say, is useless for wildlife. But I think our key piece of advice, if there's one thing we'd like you not to do, go on, Chris.
Oh, it's got to be the leaf blower, hasn't it? Really? It just drives me nuts. You know? All you're doing is blowing one thing to another place, to back again. And of course, anything that's in that habitat is going to get disturbed. Or I think this whole idea of putting the garden to bed for winter is just a big no-no, really, for us, you know. This, it's the end of the summer, I've got to tidy everything up, cut everything down, blow all the leaves out of the way. No, that's part of the garden. It comes down to that philosophy of we are trying to keep everything within the circle, keeping, you know, we use what we've got in the garden. So leave it there, get it composted, but certainly no leaf blowers.
Pet peeve, definitely. Yes. All right. Excellent. Thank you very much.
That's all we've got time for this month. Thanks so much to Emma and Chris for joining me on the Organic Gardening Podcast, and to Helena Dove for all her insights. Do come back again next month, where Chris chats to Joe Ferguson from the Bat Conservation Trust. All that's left for me to do now is thank Kevin MacLeod for the music, and we'll see you next time.